I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
Three employees and two work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
I'll go into your van, witchy woman.
I'm Niamh from Ireland.
And I'm Emily, living in Chicago.
And we have never met in real life.
Fortunately, you don't need to live on the same continent to make a spooky podcast.
So that's exactly what we did. We created Ronan Pine, our folklore, mythology, and spooky stuff podcast.
You can find us on your favorite platform, and we already have over 35 episodes ready to binge.
Don't forget the spooky shorts.
Right. We also have a bunch of short episodes, if that's what you're into.
Come on, get spooky with us, and frick yeah, folklore.
What's up, frickin' weirdos? My name is Kevin, and I'm the host of Where the Weird Ones Are podcast. This is a conversational podcast based on guest experiences and encounters with paranormal, cryptids, aliens, spirituality, mental health, as well as conspiracies. If these topics interest you, you can find me on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, as well as YouTube and Rumble. If you have an encounter or an experience of something that you can't quite explain, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to me at wheretheweirdonesare@gmail.com, where_theweirdonesare on Instagram, and where the weird ones are on Facebook. I hope to hear from you, my friends. Question everything and stay weird.
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy.
Yeah, Declan, always good to hang out with you guys.
For sure. How are you doing today, Declan?
I'm sorry, I had to mute a burp. I'm doing good.
Good.
Hopefully I muted it. I didn't just burp into the mic. But
you did not. I didn't hear you burp.
Okay.
You're good.
What story do you have for us?
I am going to be staying on topic for Thanksgiving episode. This episode is coming out right before Thanksgiving, if you're listening to it the day that it came out. So I'm going to be telling a Thanksgiving. I think it's more of a urban legend than it is a. But it'll be fun. What are you going to be telling us about?
I'm going to be talking about David Harmon. And the nice thing about this podcast coming out the day before Thanksgiving is that you can listen to us and have a cocktail while you prep your Thanksgiving feast for your family.
Yes.
Yeah, have a little story time, a little cocktail while you get ready for the big day.
Right. And I have a cocktail that is Thanksgiving themed. I don't know if it's going to be good or not.
Okay.
We'll see. It is called the Turkey Teeny. The ingredients are, it says 1/4 cup of chocolate syrup. I didn't measure that out. 1.5 ounces of Bailey's, 1.5 ounces of bourbon, 1 ounce of chocolate liqueur, 1/2 ounce of Kahlua, and 1/2 ounce of milk. And
I don't want to try this.
I know. It might be. It's probably not going to be very good. Nope. You can grate nutmeg on the top, and then the recipe also suggested a garnish. It said an Oreo turkey, but then the picture used it Reese's peanut butter cups. So I don't know. If you want to garnish it with something.
What is an Oreo turkey?
Well, I don't know, because the actual picture showed a Reese's pieces or a Reese's peanut butter cup that they cut 1 in half and stuck it to the back so that it was like the fan part of the turkey, like the turkey tail sticking up. And then it had like a candy corn nose. I didn't do it because I love Reese's peanut butter cups, but I'm not going to buy an entire thing of stupid candy corn to make a garnish. So I didn't garnish mine. But the chocolate syrup goes inside of the cup. So I did sort of, I garnished the cup a little bit. The steps are too, I hate candy corn. I think it's disgusting.
Same.
It's like sweet earwax.
I think people that like it need to be studied in a lab.
Yes, for sure. So the steps to this cocktail are to drizzle your chocolate syrup inside of the glass. Yep, I almost said it. I corrected myself. Chocolate syrup. To form a swirling design and inside of a martini or a coupe glass, and then freeze until you're ready to use your glass. Then in a cocktail shaker, you combine your Bailey's, bourbon, chocolate liqueur, Kahlua, and milk with ice. Shake vigorously and then strain into your chocolatey prepared glass. Then grate nutmeg over the cocktail and garnish it with your turkey if you're doing a turkey. And it's a pretty looking drink. It's very, it reminds me of like a mudslide.
I think this needs to be a shot and not a cocktail.
I would agree, probably. Because
I have a feeling this is going to be lot. Way too sweet, and I'm not going to be able to finish it.
I would agree.
Because it is but let's give noon it a try. Right now. I don't, this sounds like a milkshake.
Yes. We'll see. Okay.
Okay.
Yep. Oh. Yeah. It's...
Yeah, insulin it's shot something. For a chaser. Hmm.
It's something. I don't think it's good. I don't think that anybody should make this and then prepare their Thanksgiving meal. I think you should just drink something better. This is pretty nasty.
I think a shot would be okay because it's just down immediately, one sip. But like, that's grody.
Ooh. I wonder if you could use bourbon cream to substitute for your Bailey's and your bourbon. It's basically Bailey's with bourbon, I guess. I don't know. We bought it. Dad likes it. He thinks it's tasty. He puts it in his coffee on the weekend for a nice little kick in the afternoon in the cold months. Anyway, now that we know that drink is just as bad as we thought it would be. Let's go. We're going to go to New York to the year 1902. On Thanksgiving Day of that year, a southbound train approached the Marsh Bridge near Geneva, New York. The engineer and fireman aboard were startled by an ear-piercing scream. They were even more surprised to look up and see a ghostly white figure on the bridge that was waving frantically. Alarmed, as of course you would be, the crew brought their train to a halt, only for the apparition to scream again and then vanish right before their eyes. They searched the tracks. Kind of, yeah, like a really nasty scream, but it was a ghosty ghost person that they saw. They searched the tracks in the surrounding area, but found nothing. There was no evidence of any person having been there. No footprints, just the chilling silence that followed the final wail. Later, the shaken railroad combination of words. Might be having a stroke.
What is that plant behind you, by the way?
That is my spearmint plant.
Oh. I was wondering, I couldn't tell if it was basil or not.
It is spearmint. I started it in May, and it took until August to actually grow anything of any use. And rather than letting it freeze outside, I brought it in and I bought little
UV grow lights.
Yeah.
Nice.
And it's growing. It's doing well.
Yeah. Looks good.
All right. I'm going to try the sentence again and see if I can get all of the words to come out correctly.
You can do it.
The people that work on the train, because that's easy to say, they stopped at the nearby station and they were telling their colleagues about it. And they learned that there was a very grim piece of local history. Years earlier, a southbound train had plunged off the bridge, killing an engineer and a fireman. Over the years, the story about how the guys on the train died had changed. One story involved the men being thrown from the train into quicksand and that they died there in the quicksand. In this story, one of the men's bodies was never recovered from the quicksand. Another story involved a flood that washed out the bridge's supports.
Quicksand is real? I thought that was a cartoon.
It is real. But I will say, when I was a kid, I thought I was going to be subjected to quicksand all the time. And apparently that goes back to even the early 1900s. 1902, they're saying that people died in the 1800s from quicksand. I don't know. I've never personally seen it, but I have heard it exists. Another story involved that the bridge had washed away. Some of the bridge supports had washed away in a flood. The train plunged into the water and workers died in the water. The current was so fierce that it took days to recover their bodies, and the fireman was swept far downstream before his remains were found. This may be the more likely version of how the railmen died, since there was an actual train accident reported in 1873. There were later lawsuits against the railroad for neglecting the bridge's maintenance. So this could explain the origin of the story and potentially the existence of a distraught spirit at the location. But it doesn't explain the timing around Thanksgiving, because this accident with the washed out bridge support, it actually happened in the spring, not in November or even December, nowhere near Thanksgiving. Over time, the tale of loss at March Bridge blended with whispered supernatural accounts. Railroad traffic was heavier during the Thanksgiving holiday, and travel was more dangerous during that time. The story became a cautionary tale meant to remind workers of the dangers that lurked on the rails during late autumn. The fact that the deadly accident had actually occurred several months after Thanksgiving wasn't part of the story at all. The legend of the Thanksgiving ghost gained national attention, with reports appearing in newspapers such as Salt Lake Telegram in December of 1902, further cementing the story into American ghost lore. By the 20th century, witnesses started to claim that they saw a shrieking phantom at Marsh Bridge over Thanksgiving every year. Some described a white figure screaming at trains, while others saw footprints in the frost or felt an overwhelming sense of dread when crossing the bridge alone. Occasionally, railroaders would warn newcomers about the ghost, saying that spirits of the lost crew had never truly left and were there to caution the living about the hazards of neglect and fate. Curiously, historical records do not link the original train disaster directly to Thanksgiving. Rather, the deadly March flood occurred in the transitional season between winter and spring. Again, no idea why they're now connecting the two, but ghosts can't tell time. I don't know. People who love the folklore believe that over generations, people may have confused the date with Thanksgiving. I don't know how you do that, but whatever. It eventually shifted the legend's anniversary and gave it its modern nickname. Others theorize that the ghost story was popularized by railroaders themselves, meant to keep workers alert during holiday shifts when the travel was heavy and attention was critical. Thanksgiving thus became the temporal anchor for retelling the legend, adding to it the sense of annual ritual and reinforcing its grip on local imagination. Even in recent years, social media posts and local retellings have rekindled interest, encouraging both skeptics and believers to visit Marsh Bridge and try to glimpse the phantom themselves. There's only a few sources about this story, and so in my opinion, it really kind of falls more into an urban myth category than it does into like a paranormal experience, because I would think if a lot of people were experiencing that, there would be more stories on it at least, but there weren't a lot.
I kind of want to start covering more urban myths. They're interesting.
Yes, it is. It is an interesting topic when you think about like where it came from and why and
like how it develops. Like,
yeah,
one guy sees something and then he tells the town, and then maybe it starts, people start thinking right about it and manifesting it in their own brain. It's like, no, it's just a dog, but it had to be a chupacabra.
It was a chupacabra. I'm sure of it. It was just a dog with mange.
It was one of those xylophone dogs, rabies, whatever they call. The ugly hairless ones.
Yes, yes, yes. The other thing with this story is that Thanksgiving is not the same date every year. It's not like Christmas, where it's December 25th or the 4th of July. This is always, it's in November and it's a Thursday, but it's a different actual number day. So I guess around Thanksgiving time would make you think. Anyway, that's my Thanksgiving ghost story.
Interesting.
So tell us about David Harmon.
Okay. So on a quiet winter morning in 1982, in the peaceful suburban community of, I should have looked this up, Olathe, Kansas. Close enough. A young banker named David Harmon was found brutally beaten to death in his own bedroom. His wife, Melinda, claims she had been knocked unconscious by intruders who stormed into the home in the dead of the night. But what looked like a violent home invasion would unravel into one of Kansas's most shocking betrayals. A cold case involving lies, a hidden love affair, and a tight-knit religious community. Okay. And a pair of killers who had thought they'd gotten away with murder. David Harmon and Melinda Emerson met through their church community in the late 1970s. Both were raised with the Nazarene Church, a conservative Christian environment that emphasized modesty, purity, and above all else, the sanctity of marriage. Divorce was taboo, frowned upon in both the church and culturally in their community.
Usually it is.
David was known as a soft-spoken, polite, and reliable person. He grew up in Kansas, the kind of person who made friends easily and kept them for life. By his early 20s, he had already established himself as a promising young banker. Colleagues described him as intelligent and calm under pressure, a future leader at the bank where he worked. Melinda, by comparison, was social, energetic, and charismatic. Friends remembered her as someone who loved attention and thrived in social settings. She was also deeply connected to the Nazarene community, and her identity was rooted in faith and the expectations placed on her as a young Christian woman. They married young, and as many couples did in their church, they kind of sped through their dating just to get to marriage, basically. So David was 23 and Melinda was 22 when they got married, which is, oh, that is so young.
It is terrifyingly young.
I can imagine being married at 23. Well, maybe that's how old Dylan was. No, I think
he was older. Probably.
Because I think he's older than me, and that was last year, maybe a year or two. So underneath the surface, those who knew them remembered something else other than their outward-facing life.
Always.
There was a subtle strain on their relationship. David was dedicated, steady, and mild-mannered. Melinda, meanwhile, seemed restless. She wanted more excitement, more social interaction, and more spark out of their marriage.
Okay.
And in 1981, she finally found that spark, but it wasn't with David.
No.
It was with his best friend.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's not good.
So Mark Mangelsdorf was one of David Harmon's very close friends. Mark was charismatic, ambitious. He was a college student who quickly became a fixture in Harmon's home. David had taken him under his wing, almost like a younger brother. Mark would often come over for dinner, just hang out at the house, and regularly was in their lives. He was handsome, confident, and had a magnetic personality, something that clearly drew Melinda in. By late 1981, Mark and Melinda were spending their time together without David. And church members whispered that the connection between them seemed too familiar and too comfortable. Mm-hmm. Privately, the relationship had crossed into a full-on affair, quietly being hidden by Melinda's and Mark's polite facade.
Oops.
The affair The affair might have never escalated beyond betrayal, but for Melinda, divorce felt impossible. The social consequences would be devastating for her. She would lose standing in her church, and in her mind, it was better to just cheat than to get divorced. That's
not good.
Just get divorced. Just get divorced.
Yes, exactly.
Get over it. So they wanted to continue their relationship, but felt David was in the way, so they began to plan his murder.
Of course, because you can't get divorced, but you can be a widower. You can be a widow.
I mean, you get, instead of half, you get all of his money.
Valid. But how much money could they have had? Was it worth it? No.
He was a banker. He must have had a lot of money.
So? He didn't, that doesn't mean anything. He worked at a bank.
He has access to a lot of money.
Yeah, but doesn't mean he had any of it.
So the plan was simple. Kill David in his sleep, stage a home invasion, and create a story that couldn't be disproven.
Okay.
Shortly after midnight on February 28th, 1982, while David lay asleep in their bedroom, the plan went into motion. So according to Melinda's story, when police discovered David deceased in his bed, Melinda would tell the investigators that she and David had gone to bed like normal. In the middle of the night, she claimed she awoke to the sound of men inside the home, two intruders demanding keys to the bank where David worked. She said one of the intruders knocked her unconscious. When she came to, the men were gone and David was dead. It was a story that at the time seemed believable. violent robberies weren't unheard of and banks were frequent targets. So if they figured out,
right,
hey, this guy opens up the bank every morning, let's go rob him.
He's got the keys.
I just saw that in a movie recently. I can't remember what movie I was watching, but they kidnapped a banker and got into the... Oh, it was with Billy Bob Thornton and... It's an older movie, but they're like... They're bank robbers, basically, and they...
Oh.
They break into this dude's house when he's having dinner with his family and hold them all hostage until the bank opens the next day.
Nice.
Oh, it's with Mel Gibson, too, I think. I think it's Mel Gibson and Billy Bob Thornton. It's a good movie. Okay. You should check it out. I can't remember the name of it, but if you could find it easily. Okay, where was I? Breaking off on a tangent. Okay, so investigators later determined that the attack was carried out by Mark while Melinda assisted. David, asleep and unaware, was ambushed in bed. The attack was vicious, a frenzy of blows from a blunt object that shattered bone and caused catastrophic head trauma.
Yeah.
The bedroom showed signs of struggle, but not the kind of typical break-in. There was no signs of forced entry, no stolen items, and no footprints or evidence to support the idea of intruders. And along with the evidence of the fight, his eye had been knocked out of his head.
Oh! Dude, you know that's how I am violent, about eyes.
That's how violent it was. It was.
Okay.
One of the most telling pieces of evidence was Melinda herself. She claimed she had been struck in the head hard enough to knock her out, but her injuries didn't match that claim. Not even close.
She didn't have any bruises hard enough to get knocked out. Yeah,
there's signs you've been hit that hard, like swelling and at least run into a door frame or something. Make it seem like you tried. There was also the issue of the nightgown. If she had been dragged or knocked out near her husband's body, and she would have been covered in his blood. Obviously, you're sleeping next to your husband. If his eye pops out, there's probably blood all over that fucking bed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're going to have blood splatter on you from... him being attacked, even if you're unconscious.
It's like when you step on a ketchup packet, it all goes forward.
Everywhere.
Like,
everywhere. You're still going to find ketchup on the ceiling 2 years from now.
Yeah. David, meanwhile, had defensive wounds. He had fought back at least briefly before passing away.
Oh, that's so sad.
And yet, in the days and weeks after the murder, Melinda showed little sign of grief. Friends noted how quickly she seemed to recover, how eager she was to move on, and how quickly she emotionally distanced herself from the tragedy. That's when the rumors started circulating. So in 1982, without DNA technology and lacking direct evidence linking Mark to the scene, investigators were stuck. They suspected Melinda, but couldn't break her story, and the case went cold for nearly 20 years.
Holy moly.
In that time, Melinda had left Kansas, remarried, and lived in the life of a suburban mother. She rebuilt her image. Friends said she seemed like a devoted Christian woman involved in a different church, doing PTA meetings, charity work, normal things that you would expect a person to do.
Right.
However, Mark also moved on, pursuing a successful business career. He built a reputation as an intelligent, polished executive, someone who had put his past behind him. But the case didn't stay buried forever. In 2001, nearly two decades later, detectives reopened the case as part of a broader effort to revisit unsolved homicides. The new team included investigators who didn't have the emotional involvement of the original detectives. Because this was a small community, you'd obviously... I'm sure some of the cops went to church with them.
They knew him.
Yeah. The new team included investigators. Oh, just read that part. They don't know Melinda or Mark, and they didn't care how respectable their reputations were. They cared about the evidence.
Nice.
So as investigators revisited the case, they found glaring issues in Melinda's original statement. No forced entry, no missing items typically associated with a robbery. But if they were just there for the key, you'd think they'd grab jewelry or some other shit just in case like, he didn't have the key or something. But blood patterns didn't match Melinda's injuries, the nightgown, the pillowcase soaked in blood. So that was another thing is you'd think if you're laying next to your husband and he gets bludgeoned to death, there's going to be blood like a blood's not going to hit the entire pillowcase. It's your head is right. going to be blocking part of it, but the pillowcase was right. completely covered as if no one was laying in bed.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Then the biggest revelation came from interviews with people who had known the trio. Whispers of the affair resurfaced, and when investigators figured that out, they had a feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the early 2000s, investigators confronted Melinda, and after hours of questioning and faced with the evidence and the weight of her lies, she cracked. And she eventually agreed to a plea deal. She pled guilty to second-degree murder and agreed to testify against Mark. Her confession confirmed what investigators had already expected. Mark was later arrested and charged as well. Prosecutors aware of the challenges of trying a 20-year-old murder case with no living eyewitnesses negotiated plea agreements. Mark, faced with her testimony, also accepted a plea deal to second-degree murder rather than risk a first-degree conviction at trial. Both were sentenced to 10 to 20 years in prison, and all this news when it came out shocked their community.
Yeah.
Melinda served roughly 9 years before being released on supervised parole. After her release, she returned to Ohio, where she attempted to resume a quiet suburban life. I guess imagine that. Your neighbor murdered her husband.
Right. Ooh, that'd be a weird one.
Mark's life was changed forever. Once seen as a bright young man with endless promise, was left rotting in a prison cell.
How long did you say he got?
I don't know how long he spent. Let me do a quick Google.
I was just curious that she got out in 9 years, you said, and
yeah.
I think she's just as culpable as him. I mean,
yeah,
it was her husband.
Okay.
She wanted him out of the way, so.
You want me to pay for this? Stupid New York Times. He might still be in there. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I'm not seeing anything that any reports that he got out, so.
Okay. Wow.
Because she got out of 9, and that was in 2015, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, well, that's a...
Interesting.
Story of Mark Harmon. Do you have a chaser for us?
I do have David a chaser. Harman. David Harmon.
None of us can talk today. Jesus.
I know. We need to take a deep breath and try again. My chaser today is episode 253 of the Mic Drop podcast. I think you might have used the general just recommendation of this podcast on here before.
I think so.
That's a good one.
You should all check it out. He's a cool guy.
This one, episode 253, is the third part of an interview with former Special Forces military guy named Chuck Hayes. But the story in episode 3, I mean, the whole part 1 and 2 are good, but part 3, Chuck Hayes talks about how he had a near-death experience. And the circumstances leading up to it and his total experience during it. And it was really interesting to hear what he saw and felt and then the aftermath of it. Mm. It was cool. It was unexpected
experience stuff.
What's that?
I like that near death experience stuff. It's always interesting to hear, like, cause it's always different.
Yeah. Yeah. This was a manufactured near death experience. So different than a lot of the other ones that we've talked about. It was
manufactured. What does that mean?
Well, I don't want to give away the whole story, but he was learning about medical stuff in his special forces training. And the doctor that was training some of them how to do different procedures and stuff, he convinced him that they should try to manufacture a near-death experience. And the doctor was like, let's do it. So they did.
That sounds like an awful idea.
It does. Your dad and I listened to the story. I made him listen to it. And he was like, that doctor should lose his medical license.
Yeah. That's crazy.
I would totally do it, though, if I
was it 252, you said?
253.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't like that he does really the good parts, though. That's the only thing that annoys me about his podcast is, like, he'll break up a three-hour interview into, like, three parts. And I'm like, do you just play the whole thing?
And not release him on the same day.
Yeah. He releases him, once every couple of days, and it's like, oh, come on, man. Just give it to me now.
I just wait until they're all out, and then I listen to them
in
sequence. So what is your chaser today?
My chaser is two watch recommendations.
Okay.
So the first one is the movie Becky. It's got Kevin James in it, and he plays a Nazi, and he's covered in swastika tattoos.
Really?
Yeah.
That's unexpected.
A convict who breaks out and he's terrorizing. Joel McHale is in it too.
Okay.
He's terrorizing their family and looking for a key to like hidden treasure or something. And the 13-year-old girl ends up going equalizer on all the convicts and kills them in like crazy ways.
Oh my gosh.
There's this Becky 2 and it's kind of like the same deal. Like, they come and fuck with their family again, and she has to kill a bunch of basically proud boys. Like, it's like a weird militia group, and it's entertaining. Like, it's an action. Like, it's kind of cheesy. Like, obviously, a 13-year-old girl's not going to kill this 6-foot-tall guy. Right. Like, but it's a funny watch.
You said it was Becky and Becky 2?
Becky, and then I think the other one's Revenge of Becky or something like that.
Okay.
Let's see what the actual name is.
Interesting. Okay.
The Wrath of Becky is the
second. The Wrath of Becky. Okay.
Yeah. It's a good silly little action thing.
Cool. All right.
Yeah. Well, I think that just about wraps up today's episode. Thanks for listening, everybody.
If you're listening on the day this comes out, happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Good luck with your turkey coma if you're eating turkey.
Love you, Mom.
Love you, Bud. Bye. Bye.
Hey, friends. Thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.